Welcome to This Song, the podcast where artists talk about the songs that changed their lives and give us a glimpse into their creative process. I'm your host, Elizabeth McQueen, and in this episode, we'll be hearing from Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot, the hosts of the rock and roll radio talk show, Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is produced by WBEZ in Chicago, but it airs on a bunch of stations, like here on KUTX, the radio station where we make this podcast. It airs at 6 a.m. on Sunday mornings. And if you're listening to this show, well, you've probably heard Sound Opinions. But if you haven't heard Sound Opinions, well, the show is great. They don't just hip you to new music. They interview bands. They dig into music history, dissect classic albums. Like, there is a lot there to take in and to learn. So if you haven't listened, you totally should. Jim and Greg, they're music critics, and I've known more than a few music critics in my day, but I always had this, like, musician-critic relationship. Like, I made music, and I hoped like hell critics would listen to it and write something righteous about it, which didn't always happen. Like, I definitely got my fair share of middling or downright bad reviews. But, you know, in all those years, I never talked to a critic about their thing. Their art, until I talked to Jim and Greg. And for real, they expanded my own myopic view of what criticism was and what it could do. So here they are, Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot.
Well, Elizabeth, I have essentially not a great song, but I have a good story that goes with it. In 1979, early 79, it's wintertime. I grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey, and I had a crush on this girl. I was a sophomore in high school, and it was one of those basement rec room parties, you know, and they locked me and the girl I was sweet on outside. I don't know what the ruse was to get us to go outside, but it's like February and it's about 10 degrees and it's snowing and they weren't going to let us back in until we kissed, right? And so we did, and I enjoyed it for sure, and I think she did, and it was all very innocent. Nothing else happened that evening, but I said afterwards, "Would you let me walk you home?" And she said, "Well, of course." And so I walked her home, and I'm walking through the cold after I walked her 6 or 8 blocks home and back to my house, and I get home, and I'm high as a kite, right? Like, I kissed a girl. Whee! This is great. And I turn on WNEW-FM, and The Police come on. Their second album, Regatta to Blank, had just come out, and, you know, the second single was Walking on the Moon. And now, look, I think even then, I was enough of a rock critic, even as a sophomore in high school, that I knew The Police were rather cheesy. You know, but I think it was the first time in my nascent music-loving, soon-to-be rock critic career when I realized that this was a song about my life, sort of. You know, walking back from your house, walking on the moon, feet don't hardly touch the ground, walking on the moon. And that was the experience I had just had. Sting was talking to me. Walking back from your house. Walking on the moon. Walking back from your house. Walking on the moon. Feet they hardly touch the ground. Walking on the moon. My feet don't hardly make no sound. Walking on the moon. Before that, I hadn't ever analyzed a song and realized what the singer was talking about, and what he was talking about was the experience I had just had. You know, even when you love music and you consume it voraciously, there are certain songs that speak to you about a particular time and place where you are at the moment that take you back. You know, why are people so nostalgic? Why are the 72 or 73-year-old Rolling Stones going to tour again for $400 a ticket, right? You know, the people who fill the stadiums to hear them play the same 24-song set list they play at every stadium show for the last 40 years, they're not hearing the 72-year-old Rolling Stones. They're hearing the Stones At the age that they were when they fell in love with the Stones, and the same age, right? So, you know, this power of music to take you back to a particular time and place, right? Proust opens up remembrances of things past, you know, this 2,000-word novel that's autobiographical about his life, you know, by walking down the streets of Paris and the bakery door is open and he smells the baking of the madeleines and that transports him. I think even more powerful than anything like that. You know, I mean, literally, think about that song right now. I am once again, 14 or whatever I was, walking through the snow in Jersey City, you know, holding hands. I think she let me hold her hand with, and I remember her name. I remember the way she smelled. I remember the way she looked. And I don't remember nothing. You know, I'll forget my own birthday, you know, but that comes back absolutely viscerally, vividly.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's the power of music.
I mean, it is. It's like that the time machine. Like it's literally like entering a time machine, certain songs that stand out of these markers in your life.
I think the sad thing, though, is so many people are willing to stop the playlist in their head and in their life at a certain point. And you know, see, Greg Kot and I with Sound Opinions, we wouldn't be doing it if we didn't believe we're going to hear the best song ever written tomorrow. You know, it doesn't stop, but so many people just stop consuming music. You know, people who love fine dining or the theater or film or visual art don't say, well, I've seen this fantastic exhibition at the Art Institute of Chicago. I'm never going to need to see art again.
I do think it is sad that people turn off that their ability to like continue to appreciate music. But I also understand because I think it changes all the sounds of your childhood that like evoke all these memories. When they disappear, I think people have a really hard time dealing
That. You know, who likes to be reminded that you're getting older?
Yeah. Well, there's that.
But there are joys of being old too. You know what I mean? But again, I think that's sad. Why would you shut down, the entire realm of experience that art can deliver to you. I don't know. I never have. Maybe I haven't grown up. Maybe I'm still perpetually the 13-year-old walking through the snow in Jersey City.
And maybe it's because you are a critic and have been thinking critically about music since you were that young.
I have to underscore, though, that Greg and I, our entire approach to criticism is that everyone who loves any art form, but in particular music, is a critic. I mean, if you talk about it and think about it and are passionate about it, you're a critic. We have conned the world into paying us. Now we're at public radio, so we don't get paid that well, right? But we get paid something to do what we love. But I think everybody who's passionate about an art form, you know, I mean, if you and I were hanging out in the basement playing records for each other, we would be doing that. Criticism. It's a passionate discussion between people. I want to know the way you hear that song. You want to know the way I hear that song. The point isn't to tell you what to buy or to change your mind. It's the prism through which we examine life.
Well, and that was my question for you. Like, I feel like to a greater or lesser degree, no human being really knows what it means to be human. And so we spend our entire lives trying to figure it out. And art is one of the huge resources for us to go to turn to and to figure out, like, what it means to be human. But when you're a critic, it's like there's this whole meta level, because I approach music like as a musician. That's what I primarily did for a really long time. So there's the musician who makes the music, who's trying to figure out something about themselves or about the universal experience of being human. And then there's the listener who hears this and then is trying to figure out something and hopefully relating to that. Like if it's a successful song, then you do hear it and you think like some aspect of it, whether it's sonic or whether it's lyric, some aspect of that relates to me. And then there's what you do, which is criticism. Do you think like part of what you're trying to do is just facilitate those conversations about?
Oh yeah. Like, it's all about conversation. I don't think any critic worth her or his salt ever wants to have the final word on a piece of art. They just want the conversation to get rolling. You know, Greg Kot and I see the world very differently, see music differently, disagree on a lot, but we both come from that place. You just want to start this conversation. And so, you know, criticism is just articulating the head and the heart, your emotional reaction to this work of art and your analysis, what it says to you. So you and me and Greg Kot could go traipse down Michigan Avenue and stand in front of Nighthawks by Edward Hopper, right? And we're three different people, so we are going to see three different paintings. And to only, you know, I think it's an intellectual shortcoming and just like you're not really alive if you stay there and stand there and say, well, you know, my reading of Edward Hopper's Nighthawks is the only one. No, I want to know what Greg sees in that painting. I want to know what you, Elizabeth, see. And it's in the three of us talking about that piece of art. We're going to come to understand that piece of art in a deeper way, number one. But we are going to come to understand each other in a deeper way, which is almost more significant. Because, you know, you're going to see things that I haven't seen that only you were going to see, and Greg and me, you know. And it's so it's this, we're really talking about life, you know, when we talk about art, you know, and how we see the world.
Right on. Well, I'm really glad I asked you that question.
Yeah, well, we got all existential here, you know.
No, hey, that's
also
good.
Like Smash Mouth, and I can't defend Smash Mouth in any way, shape, or form. I like the tunes, man. It ain't no joke. I like to buy the world a token. Teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. And teach the world to snuff the fires and the liars.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many possibilities where I could go with this, but what's been on my mind lately is Patti Smith and her debut album, Horses, and the first song on that record, her cover version of Van Morrison's Gloria.
People say beware, but I don't care. The words are just rules and regulations to me.
So going to college, freshman year, Marquette University in Milwaukee, I worked at a Greyhound bus station as a fast food cook. Cook is kind of an elevated term for basically making hamburgers for people who are in a bad mood. But, you know, the money I would earn, I would take down to a record store every Friday and buy one record. And I sort of vowed to, you know, buy something new every weekend, to the point where I would sort of expand my knowledge, because I was intrigued by all these kids at Marquette who had these diverse opinions about music, much of which I had never heard of. So I saw this record cover and I go, what the heck is Patti Smith? I'd never heard of her, but I couldn't. That Robert Mapplethorpe cover, that black and white cover, really intrigued me. And I brought it home and back to my dorm room and played it. And that here comes Jesus Died for Somebody's Sins But Not Mine on her cover of the Gloria. And I'm like, what?
Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild card on my sleeve.
And that whole song sort of was flipping gender roles, and there was an eroticism about it and a momentum to it. And then that ding dong part in the middle of the song where she's sort of channeling, you know, bubblegum and girl group music, and in this really ecstatic sense in the middle of this erotic dreamscape that she was painting, was just thrilling and confusing and exhilarating. It was one of those songs that when I wasn't playing it, I was thinking about it.
What was it about that line about, like, Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine? I mean, what was it about that line that you said it kind of turned things upside down for you?
Well, it was so sacrilegious, and I loved it for that. You know, as I said, when you're born a stone-cold Catholic, you know, my parents were Polish-raised. They were immigrants. You know, Poland is a very stoic Catholic country. You know, you went to church every Sunday in my house, you know, along with many other people in the community that I grew up in. It was just a big part of your life. You go to Catholic school, you know, the nuns and the nuns are your teachers. You know, you have this very strict kind of disciplined, religious-based upbringing. And for somebody to say something like that in the environment I grew up in would have been like, oh, you know, that would have been a big shock. It would have been like, you don't say that kind of stuff. You know, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get a whipping from your dad, you know, when he gets home from work, that kind of thing, you know. So it was shocking to hear something like that. And at the same time, it was intriguing because, you know, what is she going on about? And, you know, I found out later that, you know, she grew up in a very religious household and she was in some ways rebelling against it. But she wasn't saying that Jesus is wrong or don't believe in Jesus. She very much believed in Jesus. What she was saying in that song and in that album and that pose on that album cover is don't use that as an excuse for not doing something. Don't use religion or God or any institution as something that is preventing you from doing something. If you want to do it, do it. Be your own person. Think for yourself. And the more I listened to it, the more that message would come through. And at first, I probably couldn't have articulated it the way I was doing, the way I am now. But over time, I found that song and that record and that artist has always stuck with me. And I always see that as kind of a turning point moment in my life where it sort of blew open a new world for me. And it was kind of a gateway into this whole subculture. You know, pretty soon we were, you know, exchanging records by the Ramones and artists like that, The Clash, The Sex Pistols, you know, X-Ray Specs, you name it. We were interested in this music that was not the mainstream and was talking about alternative ways of looking at the world that we were raised in. And that was very exciting to us, you know, and it did open our minds to new ideas and the idea that, you know, hey, it's okay to challenge authority. It's okay not to be in step with everybody else around you. It's okay to be different. It's okay to be the outsider. It's okay to question authority. So these were all really powerful ideas, and it all started for me with that song.
Was something about it being like that message coming in a musical form, because it sounded like, you know, as particularly with this song, there was something that you were hearing where she was speaking out against, you know, not against religion, but she was kind of like twisting these ideas of religion that you had been raised with into something, making them into something different. And there was also, you said, like an eroticism, something like a sexualized feeling that was coming through. I mean, do you think you could have gotten those messages any other way? Or do you think that it needed to be music?
I can't think of another art form that could have done it for me in that way, because there was something about those chords of the piano and that sort of ominous, expectant atmosphere that the song starts in, and then those words, and then it's followed by this escalating rush of instruments. And the way the song sort of ebbed and surged, you know, it was not a conventional 3-minute pop song. It was this kind of epic journey of this relationships that's being consummated. But it sounds like she's a guy singing the song, but clearly she's a woman, and it's this very, you know, what's going on here? You know, your mind is just kind of being, you know, thrown for a loop here, because it's not, you're not, you know, you're not being presented with information that relates to anything you've seen or heard before. So it was all very, very powerful. But, you know, the musical setting, the atmosphere that the music created, I can't emphasize that enough, had a big, big part of it. If it had just been words on a page, it probably would have been pretty thrilling. But I think the reason I paid attention to it at all was because of that music. And then, you know, just getting the full picture of what was going on in that song was really powerful.
And do you think, you said you were like exhilarated and confused. You had all these like, you know, a bit terrified by this song. And that you said when you weren't playing it, you were thinking about it. So at the time, I mean, later you'd go on to be a music critic. But at the time, were you trying to figure out what it was about this song at the time, or were you just like, just enjoying the experience over and over again? Or like I'm trying to figure out like if maybe this started you down the path of music criticism.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very exciting kind of experience that led me to the notion of this stuff has a lot of substance to it. It's thought provoking. And I was starting to read a lot of criticism at the time. I was already starting to dabble in writing record reviews in high school, and I didn't really quite know what I was doing yet, but I knew that I liked music and I loved writing. And the two sort of melded in college. They definitely came together. So I think there's a direct line from hearing those records, like Patti Smith's debut record, and going into writing reviews of shows and records that is very direct. I remember reading Grail Marcus's Mystery Train and seeing how beautifully he wrote about music and sort of putting it in a larger context. And those ideas were very exciting to me. You know, the idea that music was more than just about this particular record, but it was something greater than that in terms of, you know, it resonated in a way that was that sort of told you something about the world that you lived in and how you thought about it. And you could draw this kind of information out of a piece of music. You know, like a 3-minute song could convey so much information and tell, make you see the world in a new way. And it was a very short step to saying, I want to write about that and try to explain that, first of all, to myself, and then maybe to somebody else who might want to, you know, share in the experience and bring their own two cents to it. So, you know, I found myself being so excited about records that I wanted to write about them. I wanted to tell the world about them.
I mean, it sounds like part of your music criticism always goes back to that, like, room, sitting in a room with a bunch of people and saying, like, hey, you've got to hear this, but maybe in a bigger scale, trying to figure out, like, well, why do I have to hear this? And then you're like, well, let me tell you why you have to hear this. Because it tells you something about us and
Absolutely.
What we are. Yeah.
Yeah, and I can't emphasize enough that part of that listening experience, it wasn't like, this is background music. I mean, we would put these records on, and they were like sacred objects. You know, it was like, okay, now everybody's listening to this at the same time. And it was absolute silence. I mean, you'd be, you know, smoking and drinking and all that stuff, whatever, you know, all the activities that college kids, all the trouble that they can get into when they're away from their classroom. And we were indulging in those things, but they were part of the experience of listening to the music, and they really focused your concentration on the music. It was not background. It was by no means background. It was something that we took, very seriously in terms of, this is really great stuff. These people are sending messages, you know, we need to hear them, you know, it was like that kind of thing. So, you know, I can't emphasize enough that was extremely formative in terms of shaping my views on music and the role it played in our society and how it could affect people's lives. And, you know, it emphasized to me too, how important music is in our lives. It was, to me, it's always been like the most elevated form of human communication. And nothing since has ever dissuaded me from that idea.
Sleep When Dead by the Austin band A Giant Dog. And I'm playing this because one of the many things Jim and Greg do is the South by Southwest wrap-up. Like, they come to our fair city of Austin, Texas for the South by Southwest Festival, and they recap their experience. And, like, part of what they do is they go to a billion shows. And then they let you know who their favorite acts were that they saw. And one of the bands that Greg Kot chose was A Giant Dog, who you are hearing right now and who I love with a capital L, like Andrew Cashin and Sabrina Ellis write the best songs, and they play in another equally amazing band called Sweet Spirit, and we interviewed them for this podcast, and it's a great interview, and you should totally listen to it, because it'll make you happy to be, like, alive. So I was totally psyched when Greg singled them out as a great find from South by Southwest. And then Jim DeRogatis chose an Austin artist named Sorn, who I have never heard of, and I've lived in this town for, like, over a decade and a half. And Sorn is like an incredible musician and a visual artist and a performance artist, and he's writing a graphic novel with Saul Williams, and like, how did I not know about him? But that's the thing, right? Like, we need people like Jim and Greg to go to the zillion shows, to listen to all the new records, and to let us know what there is out there, what they like and what they don't like, so that we can be encouraged to be artistic adventurers ourselves, so that we can expand our ideas of what's out there and seek out the next thing that will be the bright light in our lives. If you want to hear more from Greg and Jim, you can head to their website, or you can subscribe to Sound Opinions as a podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. They've got like a lot of archived episodes, like 595 episodes for serious, y'all. I'll post a link to the website and to iTunes on the show notes page for this episode. And if you want to hear more conversations like the one you heard with Jim and Greg, conversations with folks like Tegan and Sarah or Run the Jewels or Mark Mothersbaugh talking about songs that changed their lives, then you can head to the This Song section of the KUTX website or iTunes or Stitcher or like wherever you listen to your podcasts. We have 80 episodes. I mean, it's no 595, but still, I feel good about it. And while you're perusing Sound Opinions archive or the This Song archive, like, we'd love it if you'd leave a rating or a review. Go ahead, tap into your inner critic. If you'd like to tell us about a song that changed your life, well, give us a call, 512-766-9066. Leave your story about a life-changing song, and maybe we'll put it on the show. That would be cool. And hey, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat. Our handle is @thissongkutx, or you can email us. Our email is thissong@kutx.org. And that's it. You have come to the end of another episode of This Song. This Song is a production of KUTX 98.9 in Austin, Texas. This episode was produced and edited by David Sanger and me, Elizabeth McQueen, with help from Kelly Seal. The interview was recorded by David Alvarez and Brendan Banizak. Taylor Wallace curates our Instagram account and does a killer job. Kelly Seal is our excellent intern. Natalie Gaona is our marketing intern. Thanks to Deidre Gott and Peter Babb and Todd Callahan for all they do for this podcast. And yes, it's true. Our theme song is Mahout by Austin's own Hard Proof. Be sure to check out the other KUTX podcasts, Austin Music Minute, Liner Notes, and Song of the Day on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Right on. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.